We're almost to the moment you've been waiting for. The end. We're going to talk about the PCA for hopefully 30 minutes. We'll see how that goes. Actually, this is a little bit beyond the PCA to the history of Presbyterianism. But there is the famous quote that those who do not know the past are doomed to repeat it. Because they'll make the same mistakes unless they learn from the mistakes of previous generations. And so those who do not know the past will also neglect the great heritage that the past can hold for them. So there's two ways that knowing the past is very important. So I want you to know something about the past. Knowing the past can guide us through difficult times and offer us encouragement in all times. So our big idea this morning, which is now afternoon actually, living as God's people means benefiting from the best of the church's past, and I should also probably add in parentheses, repenting of the worst of the church's past, because there are things to repent of. In the beginning, of course, it all goes to Scotland, and there we have good old John Knox, who said, "Give me Scotland or I die." So he was a very fiery person. Scotland was the birthplace of the Presbyterian form of government. John Knox, his life is very fascinating, and I haven't read it exhaustively, but you know, for a while he was on a slave galley and all kinds of stuff. Very interesting life. Spent some time studying under Calvin in Geneva, and was able to implement some of the things in Scotland that Calvin wanted to but never could in Geneva. And one of those things was church government, because in Geneva, the church was, in a sense, under the state. It was a state church. Okay, and so usually what happens is, if you talk with anyone about Calvinism, eventually this is about to happen. Calvin killed Servetus. No, he didn't. Okay? Calvin bore testimony at the trial of Servetus. Calvin did, in fact, actually turn him in to the authorities in Geneva. But he was already on the run from the Roman Catholics because he was a heretic. And, okay, you have to get outside of your 21st century mindset and get back into there where, you know, church and state had a closer relationship and heresy was punishable by the state, not just the church with excommunication. Okay? That's not Calvin's fault. It's not like he alone did this. That was the unfortunate, from my perspective, the unfortunate cultural context in which he lived. So instead of being under this state church, initially in Scotland, it was independent of the state, and therefore they were able to install this Presbyterian form of church government. Okay? He is the one, John Knox, is the one who brought the Reformation to Scotland. Okay? But as you might know, sin messes up everything, right? And so we have two different groups that emerge, and because sin had taken over the Church of Scotland. Okay, and these are the good guys, okay, I'm about to mention. The first is the Seceders. What a great name, huh? The Seceders. If we fast forward to 1661, Scotland is once again under English rule, and a few things end up happening as a result. One, the episcopal form of church government was forced on the Church of Scotland. Okay, so they thought, oh, enough of that Presbyterian stuff. Here you are, you're now Episcopal. This ended in 1689, but it had left an indelible mark on many of the ministers. Okay, they were instructed in this, and so the old school guys were like, we're finally done with this, but the newer school guys would be like, what's the beef? Okay, what's the problem? Yeah. More importantly than that was a departure from the Westminster standards. Okay. Arminians began to grow in numbers, so denying the Reformed doctrine of predestination, but even worse, oh, wait a minute. Yeah, there's Ralph Erskine, for those of you who care who that is, and that's Jacob Arminius, or Jacobus Arminius. Even worse than the Arminian doctrine was the Socinians arose, and they're bad because they denied the Trinity. So there's now a variety of theological conflict within the Church of Scotland. And the third issue that arose was the issue of patronage. And that is a practice by which wealthy landowners selected the minister of the local parish. Now, when we think of Scotland, as recently as, I looked into this a couple of years ago, and it's like 8% of the people owned like 90% of the land in Scotland. Mm-hmm. I mean, okay, you want to talk about class warfare? You ain't seen nothing in America, baby. Okay? Most of Scotland is owned by a very small number of people. Okay? And so these rich people would install the pastor. And so they would control the church by controlling the pastor. So the seceders are those who said, enough of this junk. We are out of here. Okay? And so you have people like Ebenezer Erskine, James Fisher, William Wilson, and Alexander Moncrief, who just got fed up. And so in 1733, okay, at the Gerny Bridge, they formed the Associate Reformed Presbytery of Scotland. It should be the Associate Presbytery of Scotland. Something's wrong. My brain is not connecting it. Okay, but they were called the Seceders because they withdrew from the Church of Scotland. Mm-hmm. That's the important thing. Okay. In 1737, they were joined by Ralph Erskine and Thomas Mayer, and a synod was organized in 1744, comprised of 26 ministers. Okay. That's the first group, the Seceders. We have a second group called the Covenanters. That's probably a better sounding name. The original Covenanters were those who suffered and died for what we call the crown rights of Jesus Christ. And what you see right there is a prison, a Covenanter prison, where these men who lived and died for the crown rights of Jesus Christ were kept. People like Samuel Rutherford and others. And what they wanted was the church to be freed from the control of the state. Okay? We want you guys to take care of your political stuff and leave us alone. They wanted separation of church and state, because they viewed the state control as that which corrupted the church government and doctrine in the first place. So they were fighting for Jesus' rights over the church. In 1743, their descendants, John Macmillan and Thomas Nairn, formed the Reformed Presbyterian Church of Scotland. They were strong adherents to the Westminster Standards. They held to the divine right of presbytery to rule over the church, and they used psalms exclusively in worship. Now, what you have happening is the associates and the Reformed Presbyterians started going to America. Okay. Covenanters came to America as early as 1685. They would settle in areas now known as New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and some of the New England states. In the 1730s and 40s, some of the associate Presbyterians began to settle in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, New England, Virginia, and, this is important, South Carolina. Okay. In 1753, they formed the Associate Presbytery of Pennsylvania. In 1652, I recognize, of course, this happens before that, but the first Reformed Presbyterian minister, John Cuthbertson, arrived in America. He would labor alone for 22 years when he was finally joined by others, and the Reformed Presbyterian Presbytery was formed in 1744. How's that for? Yeah, just sort of. But yeah, you're the only pastor of your kind in the country for 22 years. someone to talk to, man. It's hard. So, all right. So we have those two groups kind of coming over, and they're still independent, you know. But then something happens. In 1782, the Associate Presbyteries of Pennsylvania and New York joined with the Reformed Presbytery. They merged. This took place in Philadelphia, and initially this new denomination flourished, and the first meeting of the General Synod was held in Greencastle, Pennsylvania in 1804. But as you might imagine, division soon crept in. That's the problem with those pesky Presbyterians, okay? They're sinners, those pesky Presbyterians. We're sinners too, okay? And what ended up happening is the Synod of the South, which was the Carolinas, ended up withdrawing. I think a large part of that had to do with distance, but I'm sure the slavery issue was a factor in all of that, okay? Other synods eventually merged with the Associate Presbyterians to form the United Presbyterian Church in the North. The Synod of the South became what we now know as the Associate Reformed Presbyterian Church, the ARP. Not to be confused with the AARP. Okay, though many people going in look at that go, AARP. It is the oldest continuous Presbyterian denomination in the United States. Some of the northern churches formed the Reformed Presbyterian Church, and others the United Presbyterian Church. So, now we get to the Presbyterian Church U.S. in the South. It was formed in 1861, and it's ugly, actually, when it's forming in a variety of ways. The largest national Presbyterian church at that time was the Presbyterian Church USA, not to be confused with what we have now. Okay. At the 1681 General Assembly, the Gardner Spring resolutions were passed. And what's significant is that they denounced secession as treason. So they combined church and state, which they're not supposed to do. So all of the churches in states that seceded from the Union were now declared to be treasonous and kicked out of the denomination. So that's the formation of the Presbyterian Church of the Confederate States of America. Okay. Now, obviously, the slavery issue is in there, but it was a function. The actual split had to do with the North kicking them out because of secession. So, Gardner Spring did a number of good things. I'm not sure that was one. Okay. The Southern churches formed, as I said, the Presbyterian Church of the Confederate States of America. And after the Civil War, they changed the name. They didn't remerge, because now there's bad blood over the Gardner Spring resolutions, right?
Not that Taylor Swift song.
What Taylor Swift song?
It's called
Bad Blood. Oh. Oh.
That's the problem with teaching in school.
I'm sure. Yes, I'm sure. So they just changed the name. Okay, they did not reunite because of that problem. So after the Civil War, it was called the Presbyterian Church U.S., and it remained independent from the Northern Church. Over time, as you might imagine, sin happens. All groups of people move towards the left. It's just sort of, I'm left-handed. All people move towards the left. It's governments and everything else. It's bad. So they, of course, did that. They moved away from their conservative Presbyterian heritage, and there were obviously parts of that heritage they needed to leave. Many of the finest theologians of Southern Presbyterianism, of course, taught the inferiority of black people and the segregation and all that kind of stuff. So that stuff, we need to repent of that and move away from that. That took place. Huh?
Dabney was one of them.
Yes. Yeah, Dabney and Thornwell. So I don't read those guys. There's a reason. Other than that, I mean, if that stuff didn't exist, they're very fine theologians. But that exists. So it is an offense to others at times if we're quoting them. Edwards, he wasn't Presbyterian. He did own slaves. Yet we don't see a theological treatise by him defending that. So we are all products of our time. And so we can reject certain aspects of what they taught and believed and practiced while recognizing that they probably still are Christians. I'm denouncing their teaching, not them, in that regard. So, anyway. In 1942, okay, we're in the last century, you have a group of men in Asheville, North Carolina. I got the N from the north. Formed what's called the Presbyterian Journal. And through that journal, men like Dr. Aiken Taylor grew an influence, and a conservative community of opinion began to be formed within the Presbyterian Church U.S. So it's moving progressively to the left, but you have this band of men that are moving to the right. Okay? In the 50s, the PCUS considered a union with the Northern Church, the Presbyterian Church USA, and the United Presbyterian Church USA. And so the Presbyterian Journal was influential in preventing the Southern Presbyterians from joining this new United Presbyterian Church. Okay? Because they said, them dudes is leaning left. Not just they're Yankees, but they're leaning left. We don't want that. So the liberal groups continued to try and destroy all ties with the conservative heritage. And the conservatives began to go by the name of the Continuing Church Presbyterians. It's an odd-sounding name to us. And they began to form their own presbyteries and new organizations in an effort to reform the Presbyterian Church U.S. So if I can summarize that, the original PCUSA ceased to exist because when it joined with the United Presbyterian Church, they chose the United Presbyterian Church name. Okay? So, trust me, this is not as bad as some Baptist family trees. So, yes. A number of other groups began to emerge that were conservative in nature. The Presbyterian Evangelistic Fellowship was founded by Bill Hill in Hopewell, Virginia, in 1964, after his personal awakening from liberal Presbyterianism. Hopewell, Virginia, is where Tim Keller had his first pastorate, and one of my good friends has a current pastorate. So it's not a very exciting town. So nonetheless, that's where the Evangelistic Fellowship began. This group began to pray for revival, and it focused on piety and evangelism that would one day produce ministry to North America and ministry to the world as Presbyterian agencies. So their roots are really in this group. You had the Concerned Presbyterians, Inc. I can't believe I did this from memory once. Twice, actually, in the same day. That was organized by ruling elder Kenneth Keyes in 1964 as well to provide strong ruling elders. Then you had the Presbyterian Churchmen United, which was a group of teaching elders that was formed in 1969. It was led by Paul Settles and Dr. John Richards. And what they did is they began to provide Reformation materials to young pastors to keep them in touch with the past and pointed them to the future. So they gave them solid theological works, okay, to counteract what was going on in the seminaries, okay, and in the presbyteries. And this began to put increasing pressure on church courts to return to their conservative roots. While this is happening, as I alluded to, the denominational seminary is producing liberal pastors. conservatives wanted an alternative in the hopes of turning the denomination around. And so they formed. Anyone want to guess?
Reformed
Theological Seminary, yes, in Jackson, Mississippi in the mid-1960s. And again, almost anything that happens in the 60s with conservatives in the South is tainted with a hint of racism. Because what's also going on is segregation, and a lot of the conservatives were avoiding segregation. Okay? We can't cover that up like it didn't exist. Okay? We need to acknowledge it and say it was wrong. Okay? The National Presbyterian and Reformed Fellowship developed relationships with conservative Reformed ministers, scholars, and churchmen around the country, North and South. So, fast forward slightly to the early 1970s. The United Presbyterian Church and the PCUS had reached an agreement. Okay, almost 20 years later, looks like it's going to happen. Initially, they provided a clause for churches not wanting to join the union to leave with their properties. Okay? Guess what happened? At the last minute, that got pulled. So, the union was again defeated. But this time, the Continuing Church Presbyterians, having enough of the garbage, formed their own denomination in Birmingham, Alabama, on December 3rd, 1973. Okay. Am I behind? Yeah, 1970s. Okay. Now, first they were called the National Presbyterian Church. Then some church said, hey, we have that name. So they couldn't do that anymore. National Reformed Presbyterian Church, and they finally settled on Presbyterian Church in America. The Covenant Fellowship of Presbyterians in the South initially stayed with the PCUS in the vain attempt to try and turn it around through the church courts. Okay, so some guys stayed behind and lost the fight. Okay, eventually they would join with the Reformed Presbyterian Church and the Evangelical Presbyterian Church to form the Reformed Presbyterian Church Evangelical Synod. How's that for a mouthful? So you have the RPCES. Now, one of the really good things about the RPCES during its short lifespan was they were very much ahead of the time, and they issued a statement of confession regarding slavery and segregation and all of that. So, the United Presbyterian Church U.S. and the PCUS finally united in 83 to form the PCUSA. So it basically got delayed for a little over a decade when the conservatives pulled out. Why? Who knows? I haven't really been able to figure that one out yet. But they eventually became what we now know as the PCUSA. The PCA, my computer, there we go, was obviously located in the southeastern U.S. Initially, it had 260 congregations. In the mid-70s, they received the Pacific Presbytery into their membership. Okay, now, while this is happening in the the United Presbyterian Church USA, there's far too many of these names, aren't there? But United Presbyterian Church, in the presbytery that R.C. Sproul was in, no less, a ministerial candidate, Wynn Kenyon, was denied ordination for his rejection of women's ordination. This ended up going to the General Assembly in a big court case, and what happened is that R.C. says that before there was sort of you could have a conscientious objection and you were okay with regard to women's ordination. You didn't have to toe the line. Well, guess what changed? Now you had to toe the line. So all of the guys that held to only male elders were told, if you stay, you'll be brought up on charges. Now is the time for you to leave peacefully, which is what RC did, among others. And some guys stayed and fought, and what happens is you get destroyed. You're not David, but they're Goliath. You're not going to win. So a number of churches left the United Presbyterian Church and joined in with the PCA. Okay. Let's see. So those churches were largely in Ohio and Pennsylvania, and soon they were joined by some of the Bible Presbyterian churches. That was when Francis Schaeffer, he was part of the Bible Presbyterian Church, and he was one of the churches that joined the PCUSA. That's not PCA. I can't rewind that, can I? The main thing that happened, though, was 82. The Reformed Presbyterian Church Evangelical Synod, those guys who did that great work there in admitting the sin of the past, they joined the PCA. Okay, and with them, they brought Covenant College, whose shirt I am wearing, and Covenant Seminary, as well as Ridgehaven, the conference center for the PCA. So the PCA has basically continued to grow through church planting and has essentially become a nationwide church, although there are gaps still. You know, there's not enough in California and places like that, but we're working there. Yeah, Rena just asked me about churches in Orange County. I'm like, because almost all the ones that are there are Korean. So, yeah, lots of Korean churches in Orange County, but only like a couple of English-speaking ones. So, anyway, oh, so briefly, the agencies of the church. So you know what they are if I ever mention them. Mission in North America, otherwise known as MNA, focuses on planting new churches here in the States and assisting congregations develop outreach ministries. Its sister, so to speak, is Mission to the World, which is what sends out long and short-term missionaries around the world. We have the aforementioned Covenant College, which is located at Lookout Mountain, Georgia, which I finally went to when I went to General Assembly this year. It is a liberal arts college that develops a Christian world and life view, and a surprising number of their people, their graduates, remain in the church and serve in the church. A lot of places, their graduates, it's iffy. So I think that they do a good job of instilling a world and life view. And it seems to be a very good school.
Does the faculty have to subscribe yes. to the confession in full?
Well, system of doctrine, not strict subscription, but system of doctrine. And so, yeah, they had one guy that they had lined up. I think it was economics, and there was didn't hold confessionally to one of the main things. So they restarted their search. So they do want to maintain doctrinal orthodoxy amongst their professors. It's not just good enough that you are good at what you teach, but you also need to be doctrinally sound. So, very good thing.
So Jenny went to school.
Yeah. Did you go there?
It says where you went to school.
Okay. Covenant Seminary is in St. Louis, Missouri. We also have Christian Education and Publication, which oversees the educational ministries of the PCA. They produce some books and materials through Great Commission. If you have the copy of the Westminster Standards I gave you, that was produced by Great Commission Publications, where we work with the OPC. By Faith Magazine and the PCA Bookstore fall under their authority, dominion, reign, rule. We also have Reformed University Ministries, which is the PCA ministry to college students, focusing on evangelism and discipleship. And they have a strong connection with the local church and getting the teenagers and college students into the local church. Ridgehaven, which I mentioned, the Conference and Retreat Center in Brevard, North Carolina. And we also have the Administrative Committee, which is located in Metro Atlanta, which works to cultivate the peace, purity, and progress of the church for the glory of God. And some people are frustrated that it's in Atlanta. It's always going to be somebody who's frustrated about something. Just, we're sinners. So, you know, the motto, so to speak, of the PCA is faithful to the scriptures, true to the Reformed faith, and obedient to the Great Commission of Jesus Christ. We, of course, can continue to do better, as always. Our practical implications. The theology of the ministers will bless or curse the church. Where a guy goes to seminary does matter. The wealthy and influential should not rule the church. I'll hold my tongue on something I know from local church history. We need to fight to keep the church free from governmental control. Church planting is vital to the continued growth and vitality of the church.
So, an interesting question.
Yes.
Do you think it is possible the PCA will do something some other churches have done in terms of losing their nonprofit status?
Where has that happened?
Doug Wilson.
Did they lose it or did they give it up?
They abandoned it.
Oh, they abandoned it.
So they could, without any restriction, take any stint, you know.
Yeah.
They didn't have to, you know, not support a candidate or worry about, we're going to condemn, we're going to condemn homosexuality and not have to worry about the government imposing anything.
As far as I know, there's no talk of that because that's hasn't been an issue thus far. I don't think we need to be in the business of opposing candidates. We can speak to political issues. If that changes, then yeah. Not required. I mean, if you're going to be a corporation, you've got to file under something. And so we'll see what happens. We'll see. Yes. Right. Also, foreign missions are vital to the well-being of the church in America. Otherwise, we get selfish, or more selfish than we already are. And foreign missions are vital to expanding the kingdom to the nations. So, I have my little cartoon from Dave up here. Just remember, there are no stupid questions. Mr. Z, I accept your challenge. Are there any questions? I will not weigh judgment upon your questions. But if anything in the gazillion lessons we've covered.
Just one more in regard. You didn't mention the Orthodox Presbyterian thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you kind of mentioned all the others with that.
Yeah. They were formed out of the fundamentalist modernist controversy in the 20s and 30s. Particularly when Machen, who was teaching at Princeton at the time, was not happy that missionaries being sent out by the UP weren't actually Christians. And so he helped form an independent mission agency, and guess what? The powers that be got all ticked off at him. And so a number of pastors and churches left to form the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, and some of the faculty at Princeton left to form Westminster Seminary, which is not officially OPC, but it maintains its independence. But that was all, the whole kit and caboodle kind of happened. And so they are in some areas more conservative than us, particularly when it comes to worship styles and that kind of stuff. They're smaller, even though they're older, And their culture of how they do things is a little different. And we've almost united twice. And it came down to like one presbytery. So there haven't been any discussions, I think, since then to try again. But they are our brothers and sisters, and we like them. I like them. Christopher Chelpka's preached from our pulpit and stuff, so we hope to have more joint services with them for holidays and stuff. So they more northern, but now they're kind of getting more national now. Julian used to be an elder in an OPC church in California, so he knew Jack Miller and stuff. So. Any other questions? I almost did 30 minutes. All right. Well, from here, okay. This does not pertain to Sandy, because Sandy's already a member. When you're ready for membership, okay, you can meet with the elders, and what you'll talk about is brief testimony, answer the questions. We may ask some additional questions. You have an opportunity to ask questions of us, things like that. Additionally, well, that's pretty much it. Then you get presented to the congregation. So in a sense, the ball is in your court in terms of timing, except for you. So.
Now those people that join Sunday, are they going through a separate session from this session?
No. We gave them a pass, in a sense, because they used to be members here.
Oh, okay.
And they were coming from Covenant OPC.
Okay.
So now the two youngest kids went through the communicants class.
Oh, okay.
So they were prepared for that, but we did not require Jackie and Jack to do that. I'm glad Eric came. I didn't tell him to come. Glad he came. Usually when someone's transferring from a PCA church, we don't require them. But sometimes it's nice to just, because there's some difference in some PCA churches on some things. So you kind of get where I'm coming from and where the session is coming from on some things. So, and it's an opportunity for you to get to know me better, which now all of the people on audio will not really have.